Pardon me, but we're talking, I'm talking to it, my audience, right?
They're in control.
Oh, man, control is one tenth of it. They are inside eating you and helping you have kids. This is the amazing thing, affecting your DNA. So what did they say? So he's juggling these things?
So in the 60s,
he doesn't emphasize Lewis, he emphasizes spinning his weight because kids and everybody's taking LSD. The global theater is made of mobile media, mixed media, pre-internet within bulky media. That psychedelic reality cannot be matched by someone writing prose. Thinning its wake is more resonant, more shocking, and more pictorial representation of the multimedia sensibility, because he's got puns in 60 languages on every page. So that's why McLuhan promoted Finney's Wake in the 60s. Then he promotes something else in the 70s. It depends on what the technology is doing, determining what his position is. So Wyndham Lewis did not support Nazism. He just said Hitlerism and radio and the public address systems were the latest attack on the bourgeoisie, and that's good. That's interesting. So he said Hitler is responding to the medium. Everybody thought he was a Nazi because he wrote about him. As McLuhan said, if I speak or write about something, you can be damn sure I'm against it. Because most literate people think that what you talk about, you're matching with and you want to promote. It's a big naivety of the literate. Natural product of the printing press. Printing press makes you think that your inner reality should match with the outer reality. Okay? And we know that's not the truth. Or that's not the whole factor, that's just the eye. The ear has no ear lids, so it's always making sense, like you do when you watch TV. Television is the touch and the eye and the ear all happening at the same time. So it's got a bit of matching, it's got a bit of making. So it's got a bit of truth in literate sense and a bit of lying in the making sense. Fox TV is the last gasp of the TV body, because we're living in the chip body.
In the interior dialogue, we're all in this room and we have these other...
We're not in the room.
Right.
We got cell phones. We're on other spaces
right.
as well in the room. Let's remember.
Right. In within all these brains, there's an interior dialogue going on. They have these other thoughts. Oh, I got to do my laundry tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. Or
that's the chemical body.
Right. And they have that interior. In T.S. Eliot said, when you take the interior dialogue out of your brain and you put it on the page, that's poetry.
He said that?
Yeah.
That is a result of the telephone. And he did that in the Love Song of Jail for Prufrock, but in The Wasteland he knew more and he understood that it was a product of mating the telephone and the newspaper, so that The Wasteland is a mating of the causes, so that he knew the fascination of the interior dialogue was a result of the telephone. He didn't know that when he did Love Song of Jail for Prufrock. So you get that? There's
right,
an update there.
Right, but when I told you that last couple months ago, you said he satirized.
Yeah, that's
that. Yes.
Now, in the Wasteland.
Right. It can satire be destructive? And then I asked that a couple weeks ago at Beyond Broke, and the guy says, that's what satire is supposed to do, is be destructive. So can you talk about satire? Because now we've gotten into this era where teenage kids, if you ever try to talk to them, they've gone like beyond irony. It's like, it's hard to communicate because everything is ironic. They can't just say a sentence to you that's straight.
You're saying that satire is destructive, okay, but...
Well, no, is it? Really, what the question is, can you discuss the services and disservices of satire being destructive?
What are you leaving out when you say satire? You're not naming the cultural ground that's using the satire and what medium. So we got maybe 180 nations.
Fake news. Let's call it fake news.
We got 180 cultures or something in the United Nations. That's 180 different kinds of satire.
Right.
And then there's the media
okay.
levels. There's pre-literate satire.
Right.
And then there's literate satire. Then there's post-literate satire.
Right.
So always bring in the medium. If your teacher's not telling you what the medium they're using in the class and what's out there, you're not getting an education.
Right.
Okay.
Because I contend Stephen Colbert just pacifies people and they go, ha ha ha, and what Johnny Carson did for a million years, and now Stephen Colbert, that's all they get, and Saturday Night Live did it with their fake news. So let's say fake news on TV.
Well, first of all, it's not a problem that people are being pacified. At least they're slowing down the creative process.
That's good.
The Hall of Fame immediately.
You should be putting us all to sleep.
I am. I hope to. We used to say that on the radio show. We're here to drive you to sleep. All you other people trying to raise your consciousness. And you've been raised way beyond tolerance and vulnerability. So we want to relax you. We're cheap. We're good at it. And you'll get a heart on. But what? Sorry, that's for men. Oh, I was accused of being a boy show, so that's okay. So satire.
Yeah.
If imagine.
Yeah. Now, are you
being
satire?
Beg your pardon?
Are you satire?
I wouldn't limit myself to that. I am science. I'm serious. I like what Zappa said. People don't understand that you can do something seriously that you don't take serious. Now, that's a nice platitude. If you haven't heard of that, thought of it, you should consider that. And most Menippean's satire, the Menippean satire is the thing that satirizes the user of the medium that's being entertained. But Frank says that, but now it's complexified when we have four bodies. So you got to indicate which body you're talking to and what level. So. I think with this meta situation of people living four bodies unconsciously, they're obviously aware of themselves before any... The instant replay, McLuhan said, was the had devastating consequences because it replayed the experience pretty quickly and began with football. So a kid walks in, he's getting the meaning before the experience, okay? He goes in, he sees, oh, there's a touchdown. Then the next moment is a replay and they show you what happened, but he already knows what's going to happen. Now, we didn't have that before this replay. Everything was kind of linear going forward. Let the meaning unfold. But when you get the instant replay interrupting your metaphysical narrative, you're beginning to get a problem of your own sense of what time it is and what the collective sense is. So the instant replay was slow with speech. The cavemen get together, someone grunts something. Okay, we meet. We grunt back and forth. We get the butter made. We eat some food. We chop some trees or something. Then we do it again. And then the fourth day, I say, we're going again, and you're a bit pissed off and tired. You go, you say it with an ironic grunt. Yeah, chop the trees, or whatever the grunt is, you know, the mime tone, okay? You would do that. Okay, I say, oh, you're kind of aware of the process, right? You're making a comment on what we have to do. So there's the first meta level. Now it's complexified with media through 10,000 years of history. So today, people don't know what... They instinctively know there's nothing being said to them, that the machines are just talking to themselves. And so if you ask them something through an old medium like English, well, how are they supposed to respond when that's such tiny? So they'll grunt or punch you or
they go like that,
Jesus guy, the guy before Jesus did tonight. They make other forms of communication. So if we understand we're meta, the average person is so ironic today compared to the, quote, simpler, naive life 150 years ago where people believe the environments are in, but when you have all these environments floating since the 70s through your media TV complex and the global theater, you're going to develop an irony. As McLuhan said, TV created the highest decibels of consciousness on the form level, on the effect of previous media. Now, that's 30, 40 years ago. Look how advanced we are. McLuhan said in the 50s we're subatomic and super civilized. We're way beyond that. We accept suicide. We want to have near-death experiences. We want to have everything that violates the astral plane and the chemical body. That's why the medical establishment got into drugs. They didn't have to bother healing anybody. Just pump the drugs in them because the chemical body is a ghetto. And then we have the TV body and the chip body. Now tell me about irony other than, you know, say the Archie Bunker, Norman Lear style of TV brings irony into the silent majority. That's the beginning of it. Oh. Now, kids grow up in that. They're super irony to the point that it's an ironic gesture by these Japanese who refuse to leave their bedroom for 2 years. It's an ironic form of communication. They're telling us something. So you see these terms. There's no term that you could say in English that's relevant to what I'm saying. So you could say one word, and I'll just give you Niagara Falls with a bunch of patterns, right? Which is just miming what's going on around us constantly. Right now, just think of all the media, including bulldozers and oil companies and the ships moving the oil, and the bombs dropping, and the Chinese building 30 million people cities. All this, plus on the TV radio, the Rush Limbaughs, and who's on now? What time is it? Is it David Letterman time? Anyway, it is in New York, I guess. So look at this this ecstasy of communication. Read John Baudrillard's book, Ecstasy of Communication, 1987. Fantastic perception by a guy who learned it from McLuhan, and the Matrix model on Baudrillard. Everybody know that? Everybody know? Yeah. One person.
That's out there.
Yeah, at the beginning of the first movie, someone knocks on the door, some druggies that want something, goes and gets the disc is inside a book. It's Simulacra by Baudrillard. Baudrillard, they asked him to help write parts 2 and 3. He said, no, The Matrix 1, is the kind of movie The Matrix would make.
And then Hugh did Reed's went to Midnight Special and bought all the McLuhan.
Oh, Jerry's Espionage Network that worked at Midnight Special, one day, a year or two after the movies had finished, he comes in, Keno Reeves, who I think was a Canadian, grew up in Toronto, he comes in and orders all the McLuhan. He'd heard probably my show or Jerry Mothnock about McLuhan, and he realized Baudrillard had got it from McLuhan, so he's going back to the source. Now, that would be an interesting dialogue if Keno was here. We put him to the wall about all these issues.
What films would you say are, would you recommend as a...
No films. Me, I'm the greatest fucking film. Do you realize that I'm in all kinds of media right now under different names? There are people who think I do this or that or whoever the voice is, and they have a different name. You don't know them, and I'm not telling you. You may go find them. I'm out there with about five different fucking entities and personalities. Now, that's all a fucking movie, because I don't take it seriously, any of it, all right? It's a documentary. That is the greatest form of it. McLuhan was the greatest actor of the second half of the 20th century. And the only other person who noticed this was his daughter. She said it to me the other day. She was complaining about her brother saying, my father was a fraud and a fake. And she said, you imagine him, Bob, saying that? My father was an actor. My brother doesn't even understand that. I said, you know he's an actor? She said, yeah. I said, well, you're the second person to know that. I've known that for 40 years. Now, one time in the 70s, I was at his class, and these Italian students came in, and then after we went to a little party, and they told me that they went and read some scripts, did a little, maybe they were in theater, they did a little play with him on the side, and they said he was terrible reading the script. He was a terrible actor. But they're looking at the chemical body acting. How do you act in response to the android meme and the four bodies that were being built in the 70s? Or the three bodies added to, or the two bodies, the TV and the chip body added to the astral and the chemical. There's a whole level of acting in response to the android meme, not to a Hollywood audience or a movie audience, and I'm continuing it. It will be understood, not yours. I am the greatest actor, building on the greatest actor before me, of our time. But I'm not just that. I already announced an hour ago I was the greatest scientist, eh? What's the next category you want me to brag about? I got it all covered, and it's just the perception.
Pretty good dance.
It's not my chemical. I'm a dumb guy. I grew up, in
Paris.
No, in Paris. I was a butler. Our family was butler for 300 years for one of the Illuminati families. You can read about it in my diary. And I just this dumb kid, never any education, but I got involved in intelligence. If you get an intelligence after World War II, you actually begin to see things happen. Do you know, I've never said this in public, I've said it privately, where was I on April 19th, 1943? You know where I was? You know what happened on that day? Albert Hoffman in his lab took his LSD. I was in the lab that day with my father. Okay? This is a small audience. If I went over to Daniel's Pinchbeck or whatever his name is and the whole gang that do maps and that and told him I was there, I'd be mobbed with adoration and investigated worse than Warren Buffett, right? They'd be analyzing what kind of toilet I had and all that stuff. The point is, but now it's the appropriate time because we've come so far to 2012. You know it's 2012 right now? It's the secret knowledge is resonating right now. 2007, 2008. And it's proven because I've reconvened the Sea Council then with the richest people in the world post-Bush dynasty, and we're doing incredible things. Go to my website, listen to the January 3rd show with Eben Ray here on KPFK. I'll be on again in the next couple weeks. Listen to that interview and what I say. But back to this point, which was...
That you were a president at Albert Hoffman's.
Yes, that's what it was. Now, we were there because my father, the Secret Council 10, was called the Priory Scion, which is an actual group, but they put that name out as a fake, okay? But they actually were doing what they were doing based on documents gotten 400 years ago by the St. Clair family, who built Roslyn and the Renland Chateau thing and put their documents in there because they had a little battle with the church. That's partly true in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail. But anyways, the terms the Da Vinci Code presents is not accurate. But it doesn't matter that it's not accurate, okay? It's just Prince Charles putting it, you have to put your meme in the movie world. It's not real for the TV landscape unless you got a movie about your family, and that's what Prince Charles did. He got them to do Da Vinci Code. So we would investigate the latest technologies because we know the meaning of the message. We want to know what's coming in and how it's going to alter the situation for power, okay, including secret power. So we know that Sandoz was doing some funny stuff in Basel, so we went and visited this guy. And on that day we were with him. We didn't know that would happen that day. that he would touch the stuff and he goes home and he gets whacked out in the lab or something, right? And he does the bicycle trip consciously the next day. Is that the way it goes?
Yeah.
Anyways, he turned out he had acid that day, but we didn't know. But it was the day we were there. That's the kind of synchronicity which becomes strange synchronicity involved with the media. That's xenocrity. That was the beginning for me. But I didn't know that for decades later. But then in retrospect, I said, oh shit, we were there and that happened. So you'll find that I was the Forrest Gump involved in everything that ever happened. You know, I was at JFK assassination. I was involved in that.
Where were you?
Washington.
Yeah.
Was not in Dealey Plaza. I was mainly signed after to orchestrate the cover-up. I helped various people get involved with JFK. But that was all necessary. We believed in cover-up. Because the issue was, if the truth came out, there would have been a civil war. And you guys say, now the people have a right to know. No, when they're all inside a discarnated super angelic situation, rationality goes out the window. So everything has to be suppressed. If you understand that, then you know it's done for the machines. You don't have to listen to anything anymore. Enjoy yourself. Only communicate when you have to. When you communicate, say Bob Dogma, just to help people wake up to what happened, to which way the second coming went. We're doing a forensic analysis here. We're telling how we disappeared in terms of communication. That's all you should say.
Bob, let's
go. Any meeting you come across.
Go back to
I don't know why I'm looking at that guy.
Oh, no, Robbie's like one of the guys when I first talked to him, I said, your whole life has come to meeting, Bob.
Same
with Don. But here's the thing. We're showing in Bloomsday celebration here the movie about McLuhan turning Catholic. And you've said Marshall converted to Catholicism as a performance art piece. That alone, that's as good as when Bob had his first talk with Frank Zappa from the grave. His first question was, whether you believe in talking to people from the grave or not, but just to come up with the question, so what does Edgar Varese think of your music? So Frank's hero was Edgar Varese. He never was able to hear Frank's music, so that was it. So anyways,
that was my first question. You can read that online. I've talked to Frank Zappa twice. It's very interesting. And the second time, after we published it, I then
from
go back
the grave
to,
you talk.
Yeah, he's dead. He comes through the medium, the Evergreens channel by Michael Blake Reed, the greatest medium, the CIA, everybody used them. Okay, you know, the whole remote viewing, what is it, Stanford and the use of psychics and all that project. And that was all. That's all that stuff is a distraction from the fact that he used Michael Blake Reed up in British Columbia. He was in Toronto back in the 70s. They used him to understand what was going on. Because it was so complex, we in the intelligence agencies didn't know how to judge anything, so we had to go to the astral plane to get some approximation of what was going on. We actually did that. And so they're going to tell you all that guy's book. Probably that guy, Art, knows it. Remote Viewing, 19... What's the name of the book? Yeah, but it's Schnabel, James somebody. Yeah, you know what I mean. That book, Remote Viewing, is a scandal of the CIA... using mediums and psychic and occult stuff. They tell you who did it, and that's a big revelation, but that's a distraction from actually who really did it, and they even did better than remote viewing. Okay, why did they bring that up? It was right
I was just going to say that Marshall became a Catholic.
So this medium, I remember now, I interviewed Zappa less than a year after he died, and then it got published in Flipside magazine, so then I got him back a year later, and I said, what was Gail Zappa's reaction to that? And he says, first of all, I said, what are your fans, who we know probably don't believe in psychic stuff, what do they think of me supposedly talking to you? He says, stuck a stick in their eye, which is totally Frank Zappa, his personality. So then I said, what did Gail think? And he says, she read it, she knew it was real, but she didn't believe that there was mediumship or something coming through, so she figured that Jared Fialka, the Zappa archivist, and she knew I knew him. We got together, found unpublished rare interviews, put them together, and used actual unpublished stuff to make so that it was based on talk, but not from the dead Frank. She couldn't handle that.
Wow.
But she knew it was real. Then we got, what's the mistress' name? Lennon.
Nigel Lennon.
She had a mistress.
Yeah, Nigel Lennon.
Nigel Lennon actually wrote a book on Alfred Jarry and Mark Twain and had an affair with Frank when she was a teenager. And then when she released her book, My Life with Frank, everybody goes, oh, this is just a groupie, you know, exploiting Frank being dead. And it actually is a good book written by someone who had written books before.
from a literate person who worked with Larry Flynn on the Rebel magazine, that great revolution in 83 or 84 where he ran for president.
Which spawned Mae Brussels.
Yeah, using Mae Brussels. Yeah. So Nigel edited that magazine, and her book is called Being Frank. So she's being frank about Frank in her life. And so she's the only person who's heard the tape of it besides me, my wife, and Jerry. So she came over, we played her the tape. And after, she said, that's very interesting. When I was with Frank, he always said Stravinsky's work, The Rite of Spring, and I don't know which way it is.
What's the right way of saying Rite of Spring?
Is it The Rites of Spring?
Rite of Spring.
Plural?
Right, not plural.
Not plural.
Yeah.
Le Sac.
Right, and he in Frank with pluralized.
Yeah.
So Nigel said, we played it and talked about the Rite of Spring all the time, but he always called the Rites of Spring. It's very interesting to her that he says the Rites of Spring through the medium. You know, to her that was him. And then there was another factor in there. She also said that. You know, kind of confirmation from his mistress, but she would be the only one who won't know about the Rite of Spring issue. But I'm lucky that way. I invite one person over and she's got the key to the thing. Now, we're talking about McLuhan, right? And the Catholic thing?
The Catholic thing, but...
Why did I get into the Evergreens?
Because I made a diversion to illustrate a point, but it was basically to come back, you'll see a film about why Marshall converted to Catholicism, which isn't very good. And we're also going to show 20 minutes of Corinne McLuhan talking about Marshall, who met Marshall and married him.
In L.A.
In fucking Pasadena.
Pasadena.
And Corinne is actually very articulate talking about Marshall, but she just died about 2 weeks ago.
April 4th.
Right. Now, Bob, go ahead.
Okay, let me go into that.
Okay.
So McLuhan wrote in the 40s, he said, the artist today must influence... I'm going to look at you for a while.
She's cute. This is Phil from the Zappa world, and then moves to L.A. and starts coming to Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, what was it about him that he knew? Or something?
Lowell.
Lowell Kerouac.
He's Kerouac.
No, but he did something special with Zappa or something.
He's,
you told me this afternoon.
He's given us all the great DVDs.
Oh, yeah, right.
For nothing.
Okay. Well, is Mr. Illuminati? Is Professor Illuminati?
No, but his ex-girlfriend was here, isn't he? No. But
James
is here.
Hey, James. Just James. How long have you been here? The whole thing?
Anyways, okay. So
McLuhan in the 40s, he said that the vorticists, Lewis, especially Pound and Elliott, should have stopped making art in 1922. They put out their message. After that, radio was changing the whole thing. Most artists had to get involved with advertising Madison Avenue, like Salvador Dali, and work for the corporations. So he said, to continue the artist project after World War II, the artist must infiltrate decent society, put in quotes, decent. So McLuhan, all criticism is autobiographical, so he's saying he's going to infiltrate decent society, get a PhD, put on the corporate TV impersonal world. And so part of that, when I did his archives, found a note. He says, I always identify with the underdog. Doesn't mean he just realized that. That's his method. I will be seen as identifying Roman Catholics, American South, and I think the French Canadians, some third thing. So he's saying, I'm going to be seen as working with the Catholics, the underdog, because it's a Protestant North America. He converts to Catholicism as a strategy to allow people to put a label on him, and he also does all this other stuff and becomes a professor, but he is going to be a tremendous anarchist, spiritual, chemical, astral, and TV, amongst the whole situation. He's going to be like as dramatic as I turn out to be, you know, before I am. And so... As I was telling you, Mary McLuhan was the only person I know who recognized Marshall was an actor, a real actor. One day I was talking to his assistant, George Thompson, and somehow the religion came out. He says, well, you know, Marshall wasn't a Catholic. See, they don't know who they're talking to. And I go, remember, I made McLuhan famous back in the 60s, so George doesn't know this. He says, well, McLuhan wasn't a Catholic. I said, what'd you say, George? It's almost like, I'll give you the other example later. It's almost like the example I will tell you in the future. And... I said, George, what did you say? He says, he wasn't a Catholic. He said, George, how do you know that? He says, you can put 1,000 people, you can line up 1,000 Catholics. They're all the same, but none of them are like McLuhan. I said, that's right, George. How did you know that? Really, I'm the only person who knew that. And he says, oh, well, it's experience. I worked for him so many years. So two people. Remember Jesus said, if there are two people gathered in my name, there is the church. But one of them has to be the Pope, okay? So but the funny thing is that, so now I got another guy. He recognizes. I was at a talk by Paul Krasner and Ken Kesey on May 7th or so in 1975. They're announcing the end of the counterculture because Vietnam had just finished a week before the defection from San Diego, Saigon. They begin by saying, 10 years ago, says Ken Kesey, I believed that CIA was run by aliens. And Paul Krasner believed that CIA was not run by aliens. Now we've reversed. I believe it's not run by aliens, and Paul Krasner does. And then he said, the problem is we're like these two people in the story about the king. As his population went mad, he found one other guy, put a mark on his head, and put the mark on the king. And so when they were in the chaos, they saw the mark, they'd recognize each other. There's the two people thing. So I recognized George. To prove that, would a normal Catholic write in War and Peace of Golden Village, there are no Catholics in North America? Would a Catholic say that? No. Would he say that the Pope has got it all wrong and we need a Vatican III council, an ecumenical council, Vatican II in 62? He said in the 70s, we need Vatican III to understand the importance of what I'm saying. That's what he demanded. Does a Catholic layman do that? He did many other things to insult. He did a whole book, The Medium and the Light, where he's saying the Catholics have no clue on how to be a Catholic. So you see the infiltration? He's in there. He's working with the established memes and all the institutions and bugging them. At the University of Toronto, I always like to tell this story. He made sure he's photographed in every department. Would outrage the chairman of every department, because everybody's specialized and fragmented like Bruce, and they want to stay in their little zone and their fetish. He made sure he was seen in every department. Now that's an anarchist. I mean, Roy Hollywood puts out the same people every night, recycling the same shit. You know, this is bad. This is, and they call, no wonder Pacific is dying, and Jesus, let's hope it happens soon. Double BIA. We don't need everybody, but we don't need everybody. Think about that.
Bob, let's go into Craig Baldwin for a second, because he's a big fan of our venue, and we're connected with him in a lot of ways. He made a film called Tribulation 99, which is a 45-minute film of how America invaded South America. And it's all done with found footage, and it's actually a fake documentary. So we talked about this earlier. You know, it's easy to make Spinal Tap. You make a fake documentary. So the fuck what? He made a fake documentary, mm-hmm. And as we talked earlier also, that life is now not spy versus spy. It's spy versus spy versus spy.
Versus spy.
So, four. So Craig's new film, which neither of us have seen, and oh, back to Tribulation for a second, Tribulation 99, which I all highly recommend you see. You can rent it or see it very easily. When I showed it to Bob, he could tell every tribulation, all 99, where Craig got them.
Where the facts
But came from. Craig got them from reading too many copies of Covert Action Bulletin. And he didn't even realize that where they got it from.
Right.
And Bob could trace it back farther because he has the pattern recognition, comprehensive awareness.
And I planted a lot of the information
so
in the 60s.
Without even knowing Craig's new film, which is about the sex life of L. Ron Hubbard, you could talk maybe about Jack Parsons and go back to Pasadena here, and Jack Parsons had a devil baby with this
with Phil's camp, with Phil's niece.
Camp, right. Our own Venice, Phil Chamberlain's niece. She had one name, Cameron, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Jack Parsons is...
The Rosemary's Baby scenario.
Right, and Jack Parsons is actually Jet Propulsion Labs, JPL.
Yeah, he's a great scientist.
So you want to talk about that at all?
Well, I mentioned Dave Worster. I don't remember why, and I said I might talk about that originally at some point in the future, so we get to it. I've just done a long interview with Dave Worster, and it may be published in Paranoia soon, but at some point we'll put the audio on my website. You can hear this two-hour, three-hour interview. But it was at the Center of Integration in Seattle where the whole LSD project began. In 57, there's a preamble, but in 57, Dave was given LSD by
the government.
No, by a CIA guy, Elliot Craig.
In Seattle?
In Seattle, the Center of Integration, which was formed on Christian Murder Principles in 53. In 57, Dave was given LSD. He reacted.
With his own knowledge, he knew he was being given
LSD? Yeah, he didn't know what LSD was, but they told him they were getting LSD, but he didn't know what it would do. So he reacted to etnology in an instinctive way that was riding and surfing it properly because he had gone through a haunted house experience the year before. He was a draftsman on missiles and that. So he had no right hemisphere development, just all left hemisphere. So he went through a haunted house experience where he had jolts of electricity going through him every 10 seconds for 36 hours. And so when he took acid a year later, it was much the same experience, so he could handle it. So he surfed through it, and everybody else was so amazed, they called up Captain A.L. Hubbard up in the Hollywood Hospital.
Who is Ron Hubbard?
No, Captain A. Captain Trips, he was the man who was responsible for distributing LSD out of Sandoz. No LSD happened in North America in the 50s unless it went through Captain A.L. or A.M. Hubbard, who's known as Captain Trips. All right? You can read about this in the book on the history of acid dreams.
Okay.
He's a Tim O'Leary of the 50s. And so they contacted him, and they said, we got a guy here who's reacting on LSD very differently. So he came down, studied, looked at Dave, saw there was other bit of psychic, advanced, sophisticated people. So they set up the first recreational use of LSD, or non-therapeutic, not for alcoholics, not for schizophrenics, for people who were smart to see what would happen. Couldn't really say it's recreational because they were very disciplined sessions. And they did that for 5 years. While they were doing that, L. Ron Hubbard came to the Center of Integration and he addressed them in the nude. So that's an interesting story you don't know about. That's when he was doing Dianetics. So L. Ron Hubbard comes from Bo Kitzelman. He ripped off the E therapy of Bo Kitzelman in the late 40s. Go to the T. Townsend site and read about Bo Kitzelman, B-E-A-U. So Ron is taking the E-therapy and the E-meter, you know, later from Bo Kitzelman. Kitzelman was a member of the Center of Integration. When this article comes out, we're going to get a whole hidden history of LSD and how it was worked out with the control of CIA agents, and the higher management is Captain L. Hubbard, A.M. Hubbard, L. Hubbard, whatever he is. That structure was done before Leary did his thing. But Leary did it under global theater conditions, and it stayed... It sort of got lost for its elitist purposes and then got dispensed to everybody because LSD had become the new art form. Music, painting, sculpture couldn't handle the proper perceptual balancing to the global theater. Only psychedelics could. Marshall McLuhan writes a letter at that time. He didn't do LSD. He was thinking about it, but he said, obviously, after he read Masters and whatever, in Gene Houston, Master Houston's book, The Varieties of Psychedelic Experience, he said, this is the only psychic strategy that will give people an intuition of what's going on in the global theater and the mixed media and the linguistic unconscious. So he said it's the real art form of our time.
He was actually promoting the use of...
No, he said he could understand why people if they didn't try to understand him, they wouldn't need to do that if they understood him.
Oh.
But if they didn't have access to him, then they're instinctively going to respond to the present and they're going to try drugs. He goes into this in the Burroughs article.
And he said when we went to college, because we weren't watching TV, we took LSD.
That's right. The reason the college kids took drugs is that they were getting the drug effect at home in suburban homes, 50s, 60s, watching TV. Now in college, you're not watching TV regularly, but you need the stimulation. You need your inner TV, so they took drugs. So that's a real cause. It had nothing to do with whatever ideals Leary or Dean Moriarty, Neil Cassidy, any of those romanticists, and Ken Kesey, they didn't have any understanding. And they all ignored McLuhan. And I used to go and visit them and tease them that they didn't understand McLuhan. And of course, they thought McLuhan was some book guy. You have to realize how much McLuhan was an invisible environment, miming the android meme. You have to realize how much I'm an invisible environment, you know? That's what you got to think about. Not me. I'm not going to get laid out of this or get money or. I'm not going to touch this chemical body. But the thing is, I'm offering you, I'm doing a Jesus martyr trip, I'm offering you the facts.
Yeah, we have proof.
Relationship.
We have proof, Bob.
We have proof.
What's the most times you came with the same partner in one night?
Half a comma.
I've got a million
look
more.
At that. We got her paradigm. I love that.
I have a million more questions, but we should get this back open. Anybody have questions, that stupidity or not? Doesn't matter.
Suggestions on how we can improve our pattern recognition, or is it possible, or should we care?
Listen to my tapes. I got all kinds of stuff there on the website. You can rehearse all this stuff and study the method. I don't know, study the something that I'm communicating.
No,
you
know, Robbie,
you're definitely not. You got to work at it, and most people aren't going to work at it. So forget about it. Okay, just so you know, someone passed through, knew what was going on. That's nice, but us humans got all our private issues, plus the corporate evolution of technology. They ain't going to stop. We're all going cyborg. Okay, I talked to the Evergreens about this. Yeah. You know, in about 500 years, we're going to be 2/3 metal. It'll be very subtle metal, not bars and rods. You know, but you'll be shocked at what we're going to do. An interesting thing, the Evergreens did a special session for the public in 1978, a day in the life of a person in 2078. So in the first 15 minutes, you're talking to a young man, talking about his girlfriend, and how much he travels around the world, and all this great life, he's doing all this stuff, you know, kind of like what the most advanced rich kids might get today, in terms of access to the world, and traveling, and skiing, vacations, aspen. He's describing his whole life. And it sounded kind of boring, this is a person in 100 years, and then the Evergreens come out of that and they say, now what you've just been listening to is a 14-year-old boy in Australia who has not experienced any of these things in terms of your physical body. He's living in a matrix tube and it's all feeded into him. He thinks he's got a girlfriend. His girlfriend is living in the same circuit and they're living a virtual life. Now the wife of the medium, Michael Blake Green, was shocked. She said, that's disgusting. You know, back in the 70s, nobody thought we were going this cyborg, right? And they were quite shocked, and they're spiritual, quote, spiritual people. And the point is that this was a prototype happening in Australia, and they lay out this situation where the kids are going to be grown like this in tubes. And then we find out that, you know, 300 years, 500 years, we're going to be 2/3 metal. We are going in a direction that is shocking, would shock us. So think about that. Meditate on it. See, determine your relationship to that. Stop fucking worrying about the local media issues. Stop trying to make a living. They will give you a living.
Oh, so do you? Because I mean, it's something that is you feel a sense of rejection of it because the media, like The Matrix, presents such a negative image. All these films sort of try to make that something you should reject.
No, those are a few films. Those are just the function of the entertainment is to present a lot of bad news to sell good news. McLuhan said when he used to talk about this in the 50s, he pissed off newspapers and editors because he was pointing out that what is the good news? The ads. The ads give you new products. It's not whether they're good or bad. New products that you have to adjust to, that what you have is obsolete. So actually the ads are bad news. They upset you. Now, if you've got a lot of good, if newspapers were just ads, it wouldn't sell. So you got to put a lot of bad news in there, tragedy, disasters, earthquakes, and wars, and divorce, and drug-taking kids, so that you feel you've survived it.
Right.
So the effect of good news the effect of bad news is good, and the effect of the good news ads is bad. That's the dialectic. That's the pattern of program. That's the HAARP, H-A-A-R-P. That is a subliminal situation, okay? Now, in light of those facts, say your language, your words, with that in mind, not film. Film is just one little media. Meat is like vegetables in a market, right? There's meat, there's other media, okay. So the bad news is good news. Go ahead. No, in light of that,
what was
your point? Fit this in.
Oh, it's just that we to absorb the Android meme, you seem to sort of be welcome it, almost released to it, and it's just that's a little. It's just a lot putting.
Maybe I'm doing reverse psychology.
Exactly. I'm resistant to it.
Yeah.
I'm not defending my resistance because I think my resistance is also something I've been taught, and so I'm trying to move beyond that resistance and maybe say, okay, well. Look at it from a whole different perspective, absorb it.
First of all, Dave Worster in the Cosmic Awareness Movement, this guy who did the best acid or Hubbard study, he eventually became a medium for cosmic awareness, and the platitude that came out of him was resist not evil. Now, that doesn't mean that's the end point, but how do I get people to wake up to this confusion they're in? Well, try something, resisting not evil for a year. It will frustrate the hell out of it, you won't solve it. But at least it'll give you a model to focus on. Then shift into another level. Reread McLuhan, reread my stuff, and then try another angle. So I give you a temporary, transient, short-duration personal savior, right? A model. Now, respond to that, what I just said.
Well,
no judgment, just what do you make of that? So you resist it, so what? You will continue to resist it.
Yeah.
But
I'm lazy. I mean, I'm lazy, you know.
No. I would say not lazy. We're all lazy. It's great to be human. We have the luxury to be lazy because we build all this stuff that allows us to indulge in that.
Yeah.
Okay. And don't think that the murders and wars going on are not. That's laziness in another form. right? That's not taking any moral ethics than just enjoying yourself and killing and exerting your kinetic muscles. But the thing is put on a sense of what I'm talking about and experiment with it. And remember, your real job is just to call up talk shows or whatever, write letters editor, and say these various points, that take some general slogans. We need to bug them with incomprehensible things from their point of view. Right. We don't be a Republican or a left or an anarchist or an apolitical. Say new things to them. Yes. They'll hang up. Yes. But if we all keep doing it, we all started bombarding all the media. Imagine eventually they say, what the fuck? It's like someone wrote a letter to the New York Press. They said, all the radicals are doing the protests in New York in 2004, Republican and they're just a bunch of anarchists running around and they all got arrested. What if 10,000 people walked down the street in all the same uniform and didn't say a word? Just fucking marched down 5th Avenue, then 6th Avenue, 8th Avenue, 10th Avenue, and then disappeared. What the fuck was that? That would scare people. And they do that in New York. You've seen the nudians. They all show up, they all get dressed and undressed and get photographed at 6 in the morning, and there's spontaneous and that's just that. But there's other ways to do it.
There's kids who go into
Walmart.
I'm
saying do that, be a robot, and communicate the Bob knowledge whenever you interact with the corporate media. Or even the individual media. When you see a homeless guy, tell him this stuff. There are a lot of smart homeless people that respond. They'll throw away their little street newspaper and run off and do something else. You know, try and buy the little newspaper.
There's a group of people who I'm going to bring this next, but there's a group of people who go into Walmart and they go real slow and then they just stop. But
what people say that's cute,
right.
But why don't they do it on a mass level? Because we're all fragmented, we're all a little tube, and we that's a nice little performance, but we know there's no public space, so why even do it?
Right.
Why even do anything in the public space? Yeah. It's nice if someone does that. Let the kids do it for a little while. Ain't going anywhere. It's because I'm not here anymore.
Yeah.
The population has disappeared.
And one line that came up that Marshall was fond of, what you're saying with Robbie, is carefully make plans, then do the opposite.
Yeah.
Rita.
Yes. What do you think about the quantum meme that's suggesting the possibility of human evolution into the ethers?
Well, it's what I've been talking about for an hour and a half. I expect this. This is okay. This is a good question. I mean, she's pinned it down. Now I got to find out what she thinks the quantum what? It wasn't even quantum.
The meme.
Yeah. What is the quantum meme? We'll try to match here a little bit. You know.
That we're actually shifting out of the chemical body into a non-verbal, non-local place.
Okay. Now hold that point. The quantum meme comes in 1927 at the Copenhagen Conference of Physicists, okay? We're talking something almost 100 years ago. That was reflecting the radio life. When you were listening to radio, you were in England, Dublin, and all these places. This is what blew Joyce away. 922, he gets shortwave radio. He's going up and down the dial, and he's suddenly hearing Dublin radio. Okay, he was supposed to be in exile. He didn't want anything to do with Dublin. All of a sudden, the radio zaps him back, and he's hearing the culture like he's in a local tavern. That screwed him up. Where am I going to have my exile? So he was like a quantum particle in two places at the same time. So quantum physics was an immediate conceptualization by the Gutenberg physicists, the literate physicists, to the effect of radio. So we've had the quantum meme for a long time. Now, how does that relate to the ethers? What was it?
The probability that we're all headed into the ethers to leave this dualistic.
What do you mean? What's your image behind the word ethers?
Non-locality.
Radio again. So you're raising an issue that happened 80 years ago. And we've gone beyond that.
Unified field?
Yeah, that all happened on the radio. Then color, then television comes in, black and white television, and includes the sight of where you're discarnate. You know what I mean? You're discarnate because the sound is like radio, it's a visual track, and then there's this pixel screen that you've got to make an image of. Your brain has to organize the pixel, the cathode ray stuff. So in the 50s, you start making an image, which is tactility. So you have all the senses in television. Then you start getting the satellite going around, which makes you think you're floating around the TV, radio, book, movie, newspaper, manuscript, speech, primitive, aboriginal environments all around the planet, right? So you start to feel disconnected from or floating above, superiority complex. That's why the cults start in the 60s. Messianic complex, I'm bigger than the media. And the media being what everybody seems to be sharing, that quantum meme, that etheric plane. Then it starts to shrink, the solar theater. Now the kids have all this, the quantum meme ethers as a subset of the TV landscape, because the quantum meme ethers is the radio landscape, then there's the TV landscape, and then there's the chip landscape. They all get tiny and tiny and become little attachments like barnacles to your body. Joyce's wife, Nora Barnacle, okay? Just an interesting joke in the language. So the kids started putting little tattoos all over the body in the late 70s. I met, what's his name, Peorge a few months ago. That was an interesting thing, because he started the tattoo and the studs thing. So people are putting tattoos on. McLuhan described in the 50s that television tattooed us. So by the 90s, the kids know this, so they all wear tattoos to acknowledge the TV landscape.
What year did McLuhan say TV tattooed us?
In the late 50s. It tattoos your central nervous system and your skin. Because there's a tactile relationship between your brain and the skin. The skin is touch and tactile, but the brain is. But tactility is an interplay of surfaces. So tactility involves the skin and the brain, or head to toe. So continuing this lecture here, this theme, 5-minute instant lecture, like Lacan, and you know, Lacan was famous at Carthage, all he did was lecture, right? They took notes and it became a huge school. Let's hope I get that little thing going just on the side, right? But the so now the media environment shrink, and so the little kid, it knows, includes the TV, so tattoos himself, then they acknowledge the chip landscape, and so they put a stud, like a little crystal, which is their crystallization of the little chip thing. Okay, so they acknowledge the chip body, and that through the chemical body fashion of the stud and the genitals, the tongue, blah, blah, blah. I mean, 10 years, 15 years ago, you would not believe the people you see with the studs. It's like McDonald's, right? It's a shared, agreed way of communication. So, but what does it mean? It means you are no longer inside those media environments. It's a post-communication society. So we're no longer in ethers. We're no longer in memes. We're just looking at the last afterimage of the meme, which is an Android meme. It's a machine doing, it's a robotic communication for its parts that we created. So we are in a strange situation. So I'm looking at you, and I know you got a chemical body, an astral body, which I assume is a spiritual legacy that's in there, whether you believe it or not, and you have a chip body and a chemical body.